I decided not to go to university, and then I just booked a ticket to Antigua. I was like, there's something wrong here. I'm really sorry for anyone who anyone's like eating. It was like a projectile. I can see land again, but also like, oh my, like, can I swear?
Yeah, of course.
Shit. Basically, you're only prepared to row an ocean once you've rowed an ocean. Can I slow down a bit?
Can I go back?
It took me all that time to realise. I was like, why am I being so hard on myself? Yeah, I got hit by such a massive wave. I was upside down and water was coming in.
Oh,
and all I could think about was like, this is a really silly way to die.
Welcome back to the She Who Dares Wins podcast. And today my guest is Lara Vafiadis.
Perfect.
Oh,
that was so good.
Welcome to the podcast, dude.
Thank you so much.
So I think before we begin, I should probably tell everyone that we already know each other really well because we came out and did a little short documentary with you. But let's kick off the podcast as I always do. She Who Dares Wins, Forge Your Own Path. What does that mean to you?
It's honestly, it's one of those kind of slogans and brands that I find most of the time when I see something, I'm like, I don't really get what they were trying to go here. This one, specifically for me, I think women inherently, I think, struggle trying to find what they're really, really good at. And I think we're so focused on either doing better or we don't think we're doing well enough. And within that She Who Dares Wins and that Forge Your Own Path kind of analysis and the way we kind of think about it, to me it's like it's being who we really are, and it's basically kind of not listening to anyone else, and it's just going, you know what, screw it, I'm just gonna do exactly what I want to do and not listen to anyone else. So I think when I've, especially with that the ocean row that I've just done, it was very much evident, and I had the She Who Dares Wins sticker right in front of my face whenever I could see it, whenever I was rowing, and it just gave me that kind of little bit of extra like energy, I think it is. And it just kind of makes me go, yeah, let's just do this. And let's just not listen to anyone else and just focus on what I really, really want to do. So it's that for me is just, it's key. It's just doing what you want to do. Screw everyone else.
I love it. Okay? That's the strapline. That's exactly what it's about. Well, you embodied the message of that so much in what you do. Just for the listeners here, I want to go back a little bit to you as a kid and a girl. Can you just like take me back to like how growing up was for you? What kind of kid were you? Were you shy? What was Lara like?
Yeah, so I grew up in a family of four. So I am number three, which is quite funny because I think number three always gets, I think it's either the one that seems to shout the loudest, because I feel like they're not the oldest, they're not the youngest, they're somewhere in the middle. But I had a wonderful, growing up, we were always either doing crazy adventures. My dad was one of those guys that was just like, right, what are we going to do? It's the weekend. Let's go for a really long walk, or let's go and canoe down the River Wye, or let's go and have a weekend and go windsurfing in Cornwall or Devon or something. So I think me as a person, I think I realised from a very young age, I was like, oh, there's all this really cool stuff that I can go and do. So there was nothing I thought I couldn't go and do, which is quite probably precocious when you're like eight, because you're like, yeah, I can go and do all this stuff. I think that's what kind of built me up as a person and what and who I am now. I think especially we're kind of having those four siblings, it was, or those three siblings, it's part of me kind of made me realize that it's such a wonderful environment to be in with all these wonderful people that value you and care about you and love you. So I feel very privileged to have such a kind of warming and supportive family, and to grow up in that way was just invigorating. I think I feel very lucky because I know it's not for everyone, and I know it's not everyone gets the kind of opportunities I had with my father and everything. So it was just lovely. And I was a pain in the ass, is what I'm going to say.
I think it's important to mention that, like, so your dad, which we'll come to a bit later on, is, so he was SAS.
Mm.
So that, like, already in your blood as
yeah.
such from a young age. And how did that relate with other girls your age? Did you feel like you fit in, like, doing all these crazy stuff, or were you a bit of an outsider? How were you there?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I was always the one that was kind of going out and climbing trees and getting like muddied knees and cuts and bruises, because I was like, let's go and do this thing. Let's go and run around a field and climb this tree and do all these things. So I think it did make me a little bit different if I was kind of looking at friends when I was kind of 8, 9, 10, and they were more kind of looking at Backstreet Boys and all those things. And I was like, do you want to go and do this, guys? It's really fun. So I think that kind of tomboy aspect of obviously having a father who'd done kind of crazy kind of military background and everything, it did give me this little bit of a crazy streak, which as a child, I think is just amplified. I've managed to kind of hone it down now, actually. I mean, I haven't, I think I'm going to say. But it definitely kind of made me a little bit more... I'm just very outdoorsy. I wasn't just happy just sitting and like not watching a film or something. When I went to school, I went to boarding school. And at the weekend, it was like, you can either go and do some this stuff. I don't know what you want to go and do. You can go kind of like do kind of clubs and you can join like the sewing club and all this stuff. But there was also like the farm club and like the laser quest club and the shooting club. And I remember I think I'm still the only girl in my prep school to win the shooting cup. Love when it. I was like 10. I think I also have the chess cup, which again is quite sad.
Yeah, I love it.
But it's like, it's all, I realised, it's like, I didn't think there was that, like, and I'm sure it still happens now, the things like girls have to do this stuff, boys have to do this stuff. I was like, I want to go and shoot guns. I want to go and do that. Can we go and do all these other things? So I think it's just, again, stems from my father, because he was like, go and do whatever you want to do. You don't need to do something because you're a girl, or you have to do something because you're a boy. So
I think this is, yes, so interesting. So many of the women that I speak to that have a father figure that kind of push this with little girls, the outcome is quite similar in that, you know, they just feel like, well, I can do anything. And I'm not in, you know, there's no boundaries to go and do ballet, or and you just have to wear a dress on the weekend and do. And so I think that's right. And also mothers as well. I think if mums are on board with that, then it's amazing. And you see the confidence grow with girls. And I think it's getting better now. But that for you, I guess you didn't know anything else. So perfect. Mm. And then so growing up, you explained, like, how did you get into, or how did you become to love the ocean and you know, and find where it is that you want it to be?
So it started when I was really young. So when I was about 2, my dad and actually his Greek grandfather were obsessed with sailing, and they've always been obsessed with sailing. So basically, as soon as I was kind of able to stand up by myself and kind of like do things and be safe on the boat, my dad took me out on a boat. The rest of the family were kind of not really fussed. They were like, yeah, it's quite nice. I genuinely, there's pictures of me that have such, like, I'm going to call it, like, ultimate determination on my face of, like, a 2-year-old holding the helm of a boat with, like, my tiny hands. Safe. Honestly. Like, yeah, it was complete. Parents is fine. There's no issue here. But it's, I think that's, it. There's something in it. I was, like, the kind of, the ability and like the freedom and just how fast you could make the boat go. I remember getting really excited, especially when I could kind of start going on dinghies by myself when I was like 8 or 9 or 10. All I wanted to do was to get that dinghy to go as quickly as possible, even if it meant I used to flip over quite often and kind of end up in the sea. But I think that just being out there and kind of having that complete freedom of kind of just whatever you can do, you can get this boat to go in this direction, and it's like the ultimate feeling. So I think from having that, and then I actually got to about 16, 17, and I remember having lots of discussions. You know when you had those like career advice sessions when you're like 16? Oh, honestly, I remember.
What did you get?
I'm not even gonna say.
I got bin lady for out. And actually,
I didn't even know you could do that.
Oh yeah, I got like bin lady in the waist. And weirdly enough, that was my first job out of university. Seriously? So they got it right.
That's weirdly accurate. So I, librarian.
Oh wow. Yeah.
Which I wouldn't know. Okay, so this is the thing, and I found this hilarious because it was like, oh, you're really analytical. I was really in, so I really enjoyed books. I remember saying this. I was like, well, I want to go and work with books. I just say I liked reading books. I genuinely think the guy, I remember the guy kind of doing the final bit, kind of go, oh, this is what we've decided that you'd be really, really good at, anything based in this kind of very literary world. Like a librarian. I literally looked at him and I was like, no, I'm sorry. I mean, I love books, and but I'm not going to go.
He literally just take the first thing and was like, books, go with that. Like, quick, I got to get out of here.
Bro, I found this. I found the document recently, and I was going through some of my stuff, and I was like, what is this? Like, what are they thinking? This is a good idea. So I remember having that when I was, I think it was 16 or 17, and I thought, yeah, this is really silly. I'm not. This is not what I want to go and do. But I think it was all around that, oh, so which university are you going to go to and study, I don't know, English literature or whatever you have to do to go and be a librarian. So it was like, I went, no, okay. So at that point, I think, especially with the support of my dad, I went, yeah, I don't want to go to university because I don't want to go and be a librarian or like a historian. I don't know. And it was, so I kind of at that point went, okay, let's go back to what I know I really love. So I was like, I really love sailing. I really love doing all these things. So I remember kind of having a very long conversation with my dad saying, right, where can I go and kind of learn to sail properly and get all my qualifications and have all these, I know I have to go and do these things to go and get into the industry. And he was like, well, it's quite nice in the Caribbean, kind of off the cuff. And I was like, yes, great. when am I going? So literally I decided not to go to university, and then I just booked a ticket to Antigua, and yes, then I just did all my sailing there.
So like literally, yeah, I mean, the best story ever. Just do it. Like, and so out there, you learned to sail, you got your qualifications. Okay, so then let's get into the row. So there's a reason why we met was I found you online. Although someone recommended you and was like, you need to sponsor this person. And then I phoned you, and within 10 minutes, I was like, okay, I've got to sponsor you.
I remember that chat so vividly, because I was like, I was in my parents' guest room in the farm, and I was just like, I just you know, when you just speak to someone, I'm like, I really like her, I just want to carry on talking to them.
I don't get that very often, to be honest.
But it's like, because you meet people, when you speak to people just for the first time, it's a very like initial indicator. You're like, oh yeah, no, I really like this person, let's just carry on talking.
I totally got that vibe. And then I was like, and more to the point, I was just like, who is this crazy person that is going to just row across the Atlantic, like what? So tell me about the challenge, how it came about, why you wanted to do it, and then we'll get into the actual you being out in the middle of nowhere doing this crazy ass thing.
The crazy thing. So I was introduced to ocean rowing in 2016. So I had a couple of friends who were basically kind of, they were really wanting to go and do it as a pair. Well, actually, they started off as a four. Invariably, in ocean rowing, plans changed. So they lost two people and did it as a pair. So I just got involved with it, and I was like, this is really cool. Like, I love being out on the ocean. I get to use all of my skills from yachting. But the idea of like propelling yourself across the ocean just by your own like steam, there's no sails, there's no motor, it was just amazing. So I remember watching them off somewhere in the Canary Islands, 2016 2017, and that like got the bug, and this is something I was like, I really need to do this. When can I make this work? It was the same year that my dad got diagnosed with prostate cancer, so it was like one of those years that just kind of really just stuck in my mind. And I remember having a chat with him, and when he first got diagnosed, we were like, it's going to be fine, because we're all really positive, and we have that, like, he genuinely, in all of us, has instilled this thing that we can do anything. So any mountains, like, there's no mountains that are too high, we can just overcome anything. So when he was first diagnosed, it was like, yeah, it's fine. Like, we'll just get over it, it'll all be fine. I remember him, like, running up the Brecon Beacons, like, 3 weeks after his diagnosis, going, I'm going to be fine, really, because that's just who he was. But so we had that, and I remember kind of going through 2016, 2017, 2018. He was like, he was getting better, then he wasn't. And I was all the time going, I'd really like to go and do this row, because I want to get back into the ocean, because I'd gone back into like normal work is what I'm going to say. So I'd gone back into kind of tech and working with tech, and it was obviously, I'm very big advocate of women in tech, but that's like a proper job. So it was taking me away from the ocean and the sea and the water and everything that I loved. So 2019 came, and actually he was getting better, and we had a really good, like, I remember having a really good it was like an appointment with his doctor saying he was fine. The consultant was like, it's all clear, everything's clear. And this was like the most amazing year of 2019, pre-COVID. And it was November 2019. And I thought, this is the moment. Like, my dad's getting better. This is something that I can work on together with him.
Yeah.
Let's do the row now. I was 30 in 2019. I was like, this is it. So I signed up. So it was the week of my 30th birthday, 2019. I was like, I'm on it, guys. This is what I'm gonna do. So the race was called, it's called something slightly different now, but it was the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. And it was the kind of, it's like the premier race in ocean rowing. So 3,000 miles, La Gomera to Antigua, leaving December the 12th, 2022. So I was like, right, I've got a few years, I can do all the prep. I'm really, really happy. I remember signing up, kind of pay my entrance fee, and I got sent the most extensive kit list I'd ever seen in my entire life. I was like, why? Okay. And I literally just forwarded it to my dad, and I was like, right, how are we going to do this? He genuinely sent it back within about half an hour with like notes and things saying, oh, wow, we have to get this, this, this. This is where we have to get this. This is like, I've read this really niche article in this, in like the Sailing Monthly magazine, that we need this specific like sat thing. And I was like, yes, great. So it was like from that on, from like from then on, it was like, this was our kind of project together.
Yeah.
Because it was like, let's try and let's, he wanted to get like the certain kind of best thing, some kind of amazing new device from Sweden. And I was like, I don't know what this is, but great. So it was like the thing that we were working on. Then obviously COVID hit. So March 2020, I remember getting a phone call from my dad, and whether I can admit to this, I think I can, because it's for later on. He had been advised that maybe someone, anyone who's living away, should come home because there's going to be some kind of quite serious lockdown.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't think I've admitted that very many times. So he got, within his circles of people, he's like, if anyone wants to come back, maybe do it now.
Right.
And I was, so I basically left my flat in Windsor, made the trip back to the farm, and then a week later we were in,
wow,
lockdown. So it was one of those things where I was like, this is a little bit cheeky. I quite like it. So all of COVID, I remember talking to friends in London and Windsor, and they were all like, you know, we're stuck indoors. I was like, I'm having a wonderful time walking around the farm. This is great. So it's just, it was, I think it was like he obviously knew something or was aware of something, and he'll never tell us how or why or who. So yeah, well, I remember going back, and then 2020, and then it was like 2020, 2021, trying to get the funding and the sponsorship for this row. The training was fine. That was the easy bit. And it got to the end of 2021, and I finally get to, I think it was, we were just about starting to come out of COVID, and I was just getting sponsors on board. I was getting people really interested. The charities were all great. And it was like, right, January 2022, I just about had enough funds to get the boat. So I think I picked her up March 2022, and this was like the biggest thing, because it was like the ultimate kind of, this is a, well, obviously you can't cross an ocean without a boat. So I was like, great, this is like, this is it, because it shows to me and to everyone else, this is really happening. It did make it very real.
It's not going, no going back. No. Like, I'll just keep that boat in the garage and be like, well, one day.
You can just ignore it. But I generally remember picking her up and being like, oh, this is like, it was like, the excitement, but then like the anticipation and also like the anxiety of going, whoa, okay, this is really on now. So all through March, April, May, June, I was at events. I drove that boat around everywhere. It was hilarious. Like I would drive it to like my old schools. I drove it to like, you know, like little village shows. I'd have people ring me up saying, oh, you can come and bring your boat here.
Wow.
I parked it in the middle of Malvern, and next to like, it was a big, there's a big church where I live, and it was like the farmer's market. So you had like vegetables, butcher, ocean rowing boat, baker. And everyone was like, what is going on here? But I think for the that kind of community, because the where I live is obviously, it's everyone knows everyone. I have such a recognizable surname that I never used to get away with anything.
Yeah.
But it was great. So we were all kind of, everyone would come and see the boat, and it was a really nice way of kind of getting everyone like, this is where I'm going to go and cross the ocean on. So I did, during the summer, I'd stopped working, and then I got a load of training in on the south coast. During this time, my dad's health, I think he was kind of like, we weren't really sure, and he was getting better. He was on treatment, and then basically treatment stopped. He amazingly managed to get out to Athens end of July, I think it was. So he went to go and see his cousins in Athens.
Nice.
And it was like a week's holiday with my mum and his sister. I was down doing some silly training in Brixham or something. But I managed to get all my training done. The boat was prepped, and it was the end of August now. And I remember coming home, having not seen him for 2 weeks, and it was like a complete and utter different man, different right. person. I couldn't quite, it was the change had been so dramatic from when I saw him 2 weeks ago. And then end of August, we had 3 weeks with him and the whole family, so I didn't do any rowing stuff in those 3 weeks. My sister was down, my auntie was down, everyone was just at my family home. And then, yeah, we lost him on September the 14th, 2022.
So just before?
Just literally, yeah. And it was, yeah. I just had the 1 year anniversary. And it's one of those, like, September for me now is such a strange month because I can't quite believe that, one, it's been a year, but also just this, like, having that day. And I wasn't really sure what to do on the day. And my mum and I just went for a really lovely walk on the hills and just kind of had a very quiet kind of day and as the best we could. But it's such a strange thing because I can't understand where the time has gone.
Yeah, I mean, you've done so much with that time. But yeah, I've not lost anyone close to me. So it's kind of, I was listening to something about this the other day and it's saying until you have, you really just don't understand. But yeah, I can't imagine. I really can't. And learning that when I was chatting to you, like, it made your story so heartfelt because not just because of losing your dad, but because what he did for you, like, in terms of growing up, then getting you to this, being so excited by it, and then to just, that was like me and Zoe said when we came out to film you, it was just like, oh my God, the loss here is huge. But equally, what you were then going to go and do was like amazing. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's two, it was really hard to put that into words and to show it. And you then going and doing the row. So from September to, it was December, right?
Yeah, so I had September, we had his funeral on the second week in October. My boat shipped about 2 days after his funeral, I think it was. So that was all, I had to have everything done and ready. I think I asked everyone I knew to try and get everything together to make sure she was all ready to go and ship. And then I had a couple of weeks with my family, and I basically just spent it like having nice dinners and just trying to kind of spend time with them, walk my dog, all the things that I knew I was going to just really, really miss. And it was a lovely time in a sense, because I think it's strange, because I think everyone, especially my mum and my sister, we had this obviously focus of what I was about to do, so it really helped us, because it was like, let's try and, we've got this thing, we all know that this is exactly what he would make sure, like, he would want me to be 100% prepared. He wouldn't, because of everything that's happened, he wouldn't want me to miss something or not do something because he wasn't there. So it's like, we needed to make sure we did it even better almost. So I remember having kind of a last couple of meals, and then I was off. So I had, at end of November, I had 2 weeks in La Gomera, and all obviously the prep, and then you came out, which was awesome. And it was on those 2 weeks that I'm really struggling to remember it, apart from the time I spent with you. I just don't know what happened in the 2 weeks, and it's really strange that I don't remember being there for kind of 2 weeks. And I know inside, and again just from reflection in the past couple of months, I was so odd in those 2 weeks, and I know I was, because I'm normally such a like social person. I didn't want to socialize with most of the rowers, and I think I was either feeling like I knew I was going to be alone, so I needed to kind of prepare myself and not be in that really, like, I don't know, kind of social mode and kind of go out and kind of meet them all. So I think I spent some time with some of them, but a part of me goes, maybe I should have done it more. But I was obviously kind of in this mode of just going, no, let's just focus on the thing. Just be by, you know, you kind of, and I was just getting really insular. I think I still am a little bit like that, because I'm much happier in my own company now than I am with people, which is kind of obvious. But yeah, so it was December the 12th, 12:45, off.
So yeah, just for everyone listening out there, this is, they say it's a race, but
yeah.
So everyone sets off, but in staggered parts. Staggered, so yeah. Singles, so go at the end.
Very
there
end.
Mary singles?
No.
Like, how many were there?
Yeah, there was there four of us? Five of us. Yeah, maybe five. Yeah.
And you were in, because when we got there, that was the biggest shock for us, was the size of the boat. I was like, oh, wow. Like, all the way, it's tiny.
Especially seeing like the other ones. When you walk past like the big, like the big fours ones, and the fives, and even the pairs boats, and you get to my little like shoe at the end of the pontoon, it's like, I was like, 1 hour is all going to fit in there? And it's like, I think it, for me, it also made it really like, it was a real disparity when I'd look at these boats and they were like, they're massive in comparison to mine. There's like, it's like another boat on the end of it.
But to be fair, forget the size of the boat. You're on your own. I couldn't even... Some things you can say, oh yeah, like I could do that, or I could see myself doing that. No. I was like, no, just no. But also like massive, like I remember you like packaging up your stuff and like, yeah, just, it's so much goes into it. And I think that's perhaps something people don't realise. I remember chatting to you and you saying, actually the hardest part of this challenge before you went, you may have changed your mind now, was raising the money and, yeah, and that whole prep. Like you've got to be so in it. To get that far. But then, yeah, so what was, you know, what was that like? I know you had a tough couple of first days out at sea. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so it was one of those things when I left, and I remember going around the like through the start line up like through the channel, and I was like, properly, my brother texted me about 3 hours in, was like, you've literally been beasting it, you're on like 3 knots, which is about, so normally an ocean rowing boat is about 2 knots with like a team of four. So I was powering out at some speed. And my brother's like, oh, she's gonna try. And like I was trying to get out as quickly as possible, just away from anything, away from the land. And it was like 6 hours in and I'd been going and I was really happy with how the route was looking and everything. And so I've obviously, as I mentioned, I sailed for a living. And I know the signs of seasickness. I've never been seasick. I've never even like a little bit been like seasick. I've never had that feeling. But obviously I advise people, if you feel like this and this, like if you've got saliva in your mouth, if you're kind of feeling a little bit like kind of off balance, then it's, you know, maybe you need to either concentrate or something or lie down. And I just after 6 hours felt, I was like, there's something wrong here.
Oh, no.
Because like there was like, I was getting the saliva in my mouth. I was feeling really just kind of uneasy. Yeah. And I couldn't quite figure out. I was like, am I eating something bad?
Oh no.
And literally, like, it was just, I'm really sorry for anyone who anyone's, like, eating. It was, like, projectile. And I couldn't stop it. I literally couldn't stop being sick. And it was, I tried to eat, and it was, like, that's not going to work. I just tried to drink water. And for about, so it was 4 days before I actually managed to eat anything.
Wow.
I realised I could have, like, I'd taken, thankfully, just a few sachets of, like, vanilla protein shake.
Right.
That was obviously really high in carbs and just kind of got the things in me. And managed to keep one of them down. So after 4 days of me just trying to sip water, also rowing, like, I didn't stop rowing. And it's like, it was like a comedy. Like, I'd be rowing and then I had the bucket. I didn't even hit the bucket. I was just like trying to lean over the side and like be sick over the side. And it didn't get better. And I felt so horrendous for those days. I was like, this isn't, and I was so, part of me was, I was so angry at myself. I was like, why didn't I think this was going to happen? But I was like, it's never happened before. Yeah. Even through training, it never happened. Because even initially on training, I was like, okay, I'll take some tablets or something, or I'll take some things with me just in case I feel like this.
Yeah.
Never happened. So it's like one of those things where I was like, oh. And in my head, I was like, my dad would be really disappointed because I didn't think about this. I didn't think this was going to happen. So yeah, so for 4.5 days, I think it was, so nearly 5, I was just horrendous. I managed to start eating again. And I genuinely remember smashing through like a pack of biltong, which is the weirdest thing. Do you want to eat after being sick? But I was like, yes, it's like meaty goodness. I think I ate about 3. And I remember taking like a photo, and I was obviously so pale from not eating, but I was just so happy to be able to eat some kind of like snack or something. And then, yeah, it was kind of from then on, I had a fairly good time up until Christmas Eve. So it's like 13, 14 days later. I remember having Christmas Eve and going, oh, actually, this is going to be, I'm quite looking forward to it. Like Christmas Eve and like, I've got presents. My mum, bless her, had, I'm completely obsessed with Christmas cake. So it's not a good thing.
And it keeps. So I imagine it's the best thing for her.
It's really like obviously very high in calories as well. So she'd made the Christmas cake like months in advance. So it was like maturing and all the loveliness. I think she'd poured like a bottle of rum in it. So she cut me some like loads of slices of Christmas cake. So I remember going, oh, I could eat a couple of slices of Christmas cake. It's going to be lovely. I remember I was going to sleep. I think I was on like a 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. sleep. And this was Christmas Day morning. So I'd been rowing throughout the night, went to sleep at 3, and then my alarm was going to go off.
So
at 6.
Just 3 hours sleep?
On that one, yeah. That's just my shift. I used to do either three hours sleep is the biggest amount I'd actually have in one go. Or I'd do like little like mini naps. So I do like an hour here and half an hour here. The mini naps I preferred. They're the longer sleep. The longest sleep, because it's like in my head, I was like, where is the boat going? Like I couldn't like officially sleep.
Right.
And I'd wake up every half an hour anyway, just to check everything was okay.
We'll get right back to our guests, but I'd wanted to give a big shout out to each and every one of you tuning in. Your downloads, subscriptions, and those shiny reviews you've been leaving, well, they're the heartbeat of She Who Dares Wins. Seriously, without your support, we wouldn't be here sharing these badass stories week after week. Now, here's the scoop. We're currently strutting our stuff without a sponsor, but hey, no sweat. You can keep this adventure alive. Swing by shewhodareswins.com and treat yourself to some empowering merch. Trust me, it's not just gear, it's a statement. And for those ultimate insiders, well, why not become a patron? Just £5 a month, and you're not just supporting the show, you're elevating it. We're talking secret bonus episodes with each guest, major discounts on all our merch, and a bunch of other goodies. You're not just a listener, you're a vital part of the tribe. Every bit of support fuels our mission to inspire and empower, so let's keep breaking barriers together. Stay daring, stay unstoppable. She Who Dares Wins. Let's get back to it.
So it was so.
So there was no
fragmented.
This is really silly of me to say this, but I'm used to saying silly things. There's no like 8 hour sleep.
No.
Holy shit.
I mean, it would have been quite even like when I was stuck in my cabin with the storms, they were like, "Oh, you can just sleep." And this is what happened like after Christmas, but you can just sleep because you're not doing any rowing. I was like,
and there's a storm and you're rolling around.
Don't find me anyone who can sleep really well when outside it literally sounds like someone's like hammering on the side of the boat and the boat is shaking, and even just the rain hitting the roof, you know, in like a conservatory when rain hits the roof and it's really loud. And I was like, that's the kind of just the sound that was just constant. And that was after, so I had Christmas Day, and then I had so many issues on Christmas Day. I had like a power failure on Christmas Day. Everything stopped working. I remember having to try and figure out what was going on, and I was like rewiring stuff on Christmas Day morning, and it was the stupidest situation. And I managed to get through Christmas Day, and then it was a call on Boxing Day. I think it was my brother, and he was like, yeah, there might be a bit of a storm. Like, we think it's going to be, like, you might miss a bit of it, but it's not going to be. You might have to go on power anchor for, like, a day or two. And power anchor is just a way of stopping the boat, basically, within the storm.
So you're not progressing, like, but you're also not going back.
Too much. And I remember going, oh, okay, bit of a storm. That sounds all right. Like, I'm completely fine with that. And I remember 26th, 27th, so, yeah, Boxing Day, and then 27th. This is when it was just kicking off. And I was, even on the 27th, I was like, yeah, this is not great. Like, is this as bad as it's going to get? That was like the start of it. And I remember trying to row for just a couple of hours, and I was getting pushed back so much. I was like, I'm going to have to go out on power anchor. So I put I deployed this big parachute that kind of acts as like a parking brake. And I didn't move for 5 days. So I was just stuck in my cabin. That's like, it's horrendous, because you've got the door the hatch is shut because it's watertight.
Right.
But it means when you're breathing out condensation, it's hitting the roof, and then it's hitting you, and then it's hitting you on the face, because it's like all pooling on the top of the roof. So your own breath is like just falling on you, and it's just, it's hot, it's sweaty, it's really hard to eat or drink. And then logistics, you can't really go to the loo. Because it's like, you know, you don't want to go to the loo in, like, to have a wee inside the cabin. Because one, what if you get hit by a wave and then it, like, do you know what I mean? Like, so there are so many little things. It's
so
like,
what,
I can't,
like,
do
come
that.
Come on, what do you do? How do
I
you get
didn't,
through
so
that?
I basically, I don't think I had a wee for like 2 days. So I was really dehydrated. And then I remember just about coming up with some kind of like contraption. I was hot, so I was like, I need to either go out and have a wee. But it was so rough. I remember opening the hatch door, and then literally within a second this wave was coming towards me, so I like shut it quickly, and it like slammed into the door. So I did realize, I was like, if I can make some contraption, so I did, to have a wee.
Love it.
It's the things you have to do, right?
It wasn't a she-wee, because they are atrocious.
Yes, exactly. I don't think, I'm sorry, she-wee, but I think you need to work on it, because I don't think it's very good. But it's so I did. I just worked on some kind of contraption. Maybe I should market that.
Yeah.
I'm sure I can still find it. Plastic bottles and some kind of weird thing. So I remember kind of that, but it was, yeah, you couldn't sleep in that environment because I think you're the anxiety and your adrenaline levels are so like pumping because like the noise and everything. And I was like, I never thought the boat was going to break or the boat was going to get damaged, but just the sound of it all, you can't help but think it. It's like, I think I'm going to be, I'll be okay, but I'm just going to stay awake really, like my eyes really wide. And I remember speaking to my brother on maybe day four and he was like, Laura, you sound really like zoned out. Like, what's wrong? And I was like, I haven't slept, guys. I just can't. I think I managed to maybe get a couple of hours sleep on that evening because the storm was just about calming down. And then, yeah, I managed to just about move, I think, on day five.
So did you flip over at any point?
In that one, no. But on January the 14th, I did. And it was a funny one because I'd gone through the storm. I'd had another storm at the beginning of the year. And actually, I was in quite a good state, like the boat was going okay, and I remember it was late at night, I was putting my oars down, I'd put my washing out to try and dry, as you do, I'd attached my oars, not kind of like they were going to get stowed away, but just so they weren't going to come like flap out everywhere kind of thing. I was going in my cabin for just a nap. I remember putting one of the latches down on the hatch. And honestly, I got hit by such a massive wave on the side of my boat. So it was just like, it was a rogue wave, basically. So it wasn't in the same position as every other, like, other wave. It must have been massive because it hit the side of the boat with such force that I flew into my nav station. So it was a big kind of very chunky thing on the side of my cabin. It pushed the boat over and I was then upside down. And I remember just thinking, okay.
With the boat above you.
Yeah, yeah. So I was just stuck, basically. I didn't know what to do. So I was, I had to do my, my dad and my mum, bless them, taught me how to do box breathing.
Right.
Have you heard of this? It's like it's four in, hold for four, out for four, hold for four.
Right.
And I think it's something that either Navy SEALs do,
right,
or Special Forces do. And it's like when you're going into an environment that's going to be really stress inducing and anxiety inducing, box breathing just does something for you. So I remember just going, okay, breathe. Like, do the breathing. Because I'd only just got in my cabin, the hatch wasn't shut properly. I was upside down and water was coming in.
Oh, God.
And I remember going, okay, right, think quickly. So I managed to get the latch shut. My vent was open because I had it open from when I was sleeping in the day and it gets really hot because it's like a sauna. Water coming is in there. So I was stuffing anything I could find in there. And then I was also trying to get the boat. I was like moving back and forth to try and get the boat to go back up again. And all I could think about was like, this is a really silly way to die. Like this, this is just really, it's really, really stupid. And because I didn't see it coming, it annoyed me even more. And I was like, why didn't I? I was like, obviously I couldn't. But in my head, I just go into like self-critical mode. I was like, this is your fault. Like what's happened here? So it was only about a minute and a half to two from like rocking backwards and forth and just trying to get the boat to go back up. And she kind of just flips herself back up again. And the cabin was a mess. I had a bruise and I had blood coming down my face. And it was like, this is okay. We need to take stock of everything that's happened. So within the cabin, it was just a disaster. There was stuff everywhere. Stuff had broken. Cause obviously just the force of getting flipped over. And then I had to kind of venture outside to make sure I had everything to continue the row because I was really worried. I was like, right, my seat wasn't attached as I would normally do if I think I'm going to get capsized. So the seat, thankfully, I'm very, very good at tying knots. So my seat is on like a piece of rope, like a lanyard. It was literally over the side of the boat, but my knot had still held.
Yes.
I was like, my dad would be proud.
Yeah, by just thinking that. Yeah.
So I managed to get her in. So I hadn't. The only thing I'd lost was my washing.
Ah.
I was like, I don't need clothes. It's fine. So that was, yeah, it was one of those ones. I think January, and having that, I did realise. I was like, I managed to get through that. So I can, nothing else is going to go wrong. Like if it can't get any worse than what's just happened.
Storm, flipping over, having that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd have been like flares.
Like, come and get me, guys.
Yeah. What's going through your head at that point? Like these low points of, you know, you're on your own. I know you say you like being on your own, but what mentally gets you through that?
I think, and the key for me, especially kind of with everything that went wrong, because normally when, I think obviously when we're on land and all of us, when we have a problem, when they say it's a problem shared, it's a problem halved, right? Yeah. So it's like, go and get someone else into the conversation. Yeah. They can help you. Being out there and realizing that there's literally no one that can help you, you just have to figure it out.
Yeah.
I think it was amazing. I think I'm so happy that all the preparation I did on the boat to realize I can fix everything on the boat.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm happy with all of that. So nothing can go wrong. And if it does, then I've got all of the tools. I have all of the gear to make sure I can fix everything and make it all work. I think with having everything that went wrong, there was an element. I kind of thought, right, I've done all the bad things now. I've managed to get through them. I'm going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a invigorating way to feel, because I think, and you can see it, I remember looking back at social media that I haven't done in ages, and kind of stuff that I sent back and also stuff I didn't send back. So videos I made of myself. And I literally made a video of, I think it was after the capsize, and it's literally me just like, well, it's just in such a state. And I think kind of seeing how low I got, but also the strength that I managed to get through, knowing that it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
I think the weird thing is, and this might sound strange, I think with my dad passing away and then knowing he wasn't going to be there at the end, I had like a weird sense that because he wasn't at home, he was with me.
Nice.
So at every moment he was there. So he was watching over. So it kind of gave me a little bit of like, I don't know, is it weird to say it was like my superpower, having my dad just on my shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what it felt like. So I was like, if I can do this, he's somewhere there.
Yeah.
He's looking over me. Nothing's going to go wrong.
So I was going to ask you about that. So the time frame from you like losing your dad to then doing the race was, you know, really quick. Like you had so much on your plate to kind of almost like push through with.
Yeah.
Like, was there any point on that journey where you got chance to like start the grieving process, or like, did that happen, or do you think that's something that happened at the end, or like, how did you cope with that being on the boat and having that? And I guess all the silent times and like you say, you felt him there with you, which was like a sense of comfort. So how much of that journey do you think, I guess, helped or didn't help? Or
I think because of, I know he had such an affiliation with the sea, I think having the time that I had and having my almost 3 months at sea, it probably allowed me a way to grieve that I would never have normally had. Because I think when you lose someone close to you, and obviously you've got family around you, it's a very, you know, you all feel things differently, and it's very hard to kind of maybe put it into words. Because I know my mum lost her love of her life. I lost my father. My auntie lost her brother. But it's very different aspects of who we've actually lost within our lives. So I think when I had the time and kind of, I remember leaving, like even just in the first couple of weeks, I did struggle with kind of having my brain on 24/7 constantly thinking about him. So I did find I was putting on music and podcasts to try and think, okay, let's just, I need to focus. And then I realized, why am I trying to not think about him? Because like, I have to, he's the whole reason I'm here. And I think that's when I kind of leaned into this way of grieving in a completely different way. And I did. I think I genuinely just grieved for 98 days. But I realized that all the time I had was just, it was a weirdly like a blessing.
Like
I had
time to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was like, it was just, I couldn't have imagined doing it any other way. And it was, it did work for me. Obviously, I'm still grieving now, but it allowed me space that I would never have normally had in an environment that was his and mine. And I think it was one of a blessing and a curse. I think it's definitely.
Yeah. And then getting, so 90 days. I remember Zoe and I were watching, and I was like, holy crap.
crap. Like, yeah, because, yeah, I mean, to go through all that, you didn't have an easy crossing. And then, like, what are you, like, towards the end, what's going through? Like,
I think, so I can categorically say this, the last 500 miles were the hardest miles I ever rode. Right. And it was like, I heard people say this before, they were like, because you get, obviously you're closer, the miles seem to go down so much slower. Like they just, there is something.
Slow-mo.
And I was like, what is going on here? I was like, every mile seems to take just an age because I've got my little ticker on and I can see it. And I was like, 500. And it was like a real 499. And it was like, it just wouldn't go down. I remember thinking like, wow, it's like, what's going on? And it's like, it wasn't. It was obviously going at the same time, but in my head, it was going really slowly. And I remember getting, so it was on, I think I had a week before I got in, and I think I had 2 days on power anchor because the wind just changed and blew me back a bit. In those 2 days, I actually went, I'm really quite content with this because I know I'm close. I'm happy with what's happening with the wind in the next couple of weeks. And I almost enjoyed myself. I remember sitting on my seat going, yeah, this is really nice. I'm in the Caribbean Sea, basically. I'm very near it. So I remember on the 97th day, so it was March the 20th in the evening, and I was like 25 miles from Antigua. And because it was the evening, I just saw this like dull, like glow of light of the island. And it was like the feeling of going, I can see land again, but also like, oh my, like, can I swear?
Yeah, of course.
Shit. I was like, I need to, like, I'm really close, but also, like, oh my God, I can bump into shit now.
Oh, right.
Like,
okay.
That's my thing. Yeah. It was really weird. This anxiety came over me. It was like, oh wait, there are like rocks and there's like hard stuff. And I was like, well, I've been so in my lovely kind of like watery like environment for so long that I'm like, oh, there's like rocks and land and people, like, and the anxiety was so much, it was crazy. I was like, can I slow down a bit?
Can I go back?
Genuinely. But the thing was, I knew that my older brother who's did all of my routing for me. He only had a few days in Antigua. So I knew I had to get in on the 21st in the morning. Otherwise, right. I'd miss him because he was going on a flight at 5 o'clock on the 21st. Okay. So I was like, I can't stay down. I was like, just, it's fine. So I remember, so all through that night, I basically rode the entire day and night. So I was on like hour 29 of rowing when I actually kind of was coming around the corner in Nelson's dockyard, and it was 7 a.m. and I remember kind of having like, it was an amazing feeling, also just a really overwhelming feeling of just I just started crying, just constantly, and I was rowing and I was crying. And there's the finish line is where there's like a green starboard buoy and the harbour of the mouth of Nelson's dockyard. And I heard shouting and screaming, couldn't hear what it was. Obviously my family going insane on the fort. And there was a media boat taking photos. And I heard them say, like, come on, you're really, really close. And then, like, you've done it. And I just remember putting my head down and going, oh, thank fuck for that. Like, And I just couldn't, like, the emotion and the overwhelming feeling of, like...
Was there a release of just, like...
Oh my God, I was like, it's just, and I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it. And I watched the video yesterday, and I haven't watched it very many times, but I can feel how I felt at the time. And then, yeah, I, you know, having like the flare moment, putting my, like doing the flare and kind of holding it up, and I couldn't really stand. And it
you
was
lost
just,
a lot of weight. Like, I think that's what a lot of people won't realise is obviously being sick for like the first 5 days as well, but the physical challenge of this is something that actually you kind of wash over. Like, I feel like you wash it, and I'm like,
I've been told that before.
I'm like, dude, this isn't just you getting a like, you're not just casually rowing across it. The physical illness is huge.
I think it's because, like, initially it's so, like, the first five, I'm going to say the first 2 weeks of the row are just horrendous because your body is just trying to get used to this huge amount of rowing.
Yeah.
But genuinely, like, it's still hard, but it's just amazing how your body, like...
Adapts.
And it's like, it just gets used to this is what it does. So we're doing 16 hours or 17 hours of rowing a day. This is what we eat. This is what we drink. This is what we... And it's just... I think the thing that lets people down or maybe causes them issues is that mental strength. Yeah. But I think because I had the massive motivation of my dad and everything that went with that, and just me, I'm a very stubborn person. There was no way I wasn't gonna get through it. You know, there was, I had to get to that finish line if it was gonna kill me. And I remember my partner, I laugh because it's kind of true, but he said he knew I was either gonna do it or die trying. And it's a horrendous thing to say, but I was so sure I had to finish it. Whatever happened, whether the, I know I would have bloody swum it, I think, if the boat, it's like, I would have got there, or I would have gotten my life raft and started paddling that or something. So I think that was amazing. And that kind of like my body just did what it needed to do. I think initially I probably lost about 22 kilograms.
Wow.
Which is, what's that like?
I don't know. I'm terrible with comparing
like stone. 4 stone or something. And, no, 3 stone, yeah. I think at the last 3 weeks, I was smashing any food I could get because I was just trying to power through. So I think I probably put on like 3 or 4 back. So at the end, I think they weighed me and I was like 17.5 kilograms lighter. And my body shape completely changed. I can categorically say I've eaten enough cake for the last 6 months.
You deserve it.
I'm back. But it's, yeah, it was amazing just what the body's really capable of. And it just, it was just one of those moments. I think people say like, you basically, you're only prepared to row an ocean once you've rowed an ocean. Mm. So when I got to that finish line, I was in my peak physical fitness for rowing. That's the only thing I could do, because when I got off the boat, I couldn't bloody walk. I got off and there was like 3 people helping me trying to get off the boat. And
so
I remember
sea legs
seeing,
is a thing then?
It's huge. Right. And I remember seeing my mum and she gave me a hug and I was like, I'm going to fall over. I don't know what to do. And I remember walking around Antigua afterwards for the last couple of days, first couple of days of when I was on land. And I think everyone just thought I'd had like a cracking night out. My boyfriend was like, no, she's just a rower. And they were like, oh, okay, fine, she's not just really drunk. I was like, no, because I just couldn't, I couldn't figure her out. And it was funny, he was laughing and it was like a really big pavement with a really high like pavement ledge, and I was like, no, I can't walk in there. And he was like, so I have to walk in like the road, because I wasn't confident the fact that I could stay on the pavement without falling off, because I'd just swaying from side to side. And then all the, like the ability to walk up a hill, so there's a slight hill up to where we were staying. Oh my God, I felt like I was climbing like Everest or something, because wow. My body was just, it didn't have the ability to like, just why did I just put one foot in front of the other, but for my muscles to work in that way, because they're just used to going backwards and forwards for rowing.
That's incredible, like how, like you say, how the body adapts.
Yeah.
And oh my God, that's, yeah, you don't think of that. Going back to the mental resilience, where did you think you got that from? Do you think that's something that you can learn? Because I think there'll be people out there that perhaps would potentially like to do a challenge like this. I mean, I feel like they should be locked up, but I'm just kidding.
Join the club. It's fine.
But for someone that would want to do that and they perhaps think, okay, she sounds incredibly strong, like, is this something you're born with, something you learn, something you get when you do it? Mm. Like, what kind of advice you have, or where do you think it stems from?
I think mental toughness and kind of mental strength is absolutely something that it's not like a gene that you have. It's definitely something that you can learn and build on. I think, yes, I'm lucky because I've obviously got my father who I kind of drew a lot of inspiration from. So I think it's kind of finding, having that as my inspiration, saying he went through so much. And actually the mental toughness that he had to get through cancer treatments, and that's just across the board. I think people, they're obviously suffering these terrible diseases. The fact that they can have a smile on their face and do these amazing things, and like it's that in my mind is just the ultimate in mental toughness. So I think seeing that really helped me believe that genuinely they go through this, I can kind of draw on that and do this for him. I think one, I was training and I used to get this question a lot, is how do you train to kind of get mentally tough? And I was like, I think it's just, the only way I can put it is doing things when you least want to do them. And it's like, it takes time. So it's like, either if it is going out and doing a run in the morning, you, the more you do, the more you'd want to do it. Mm. And it's like when I used to get on my rowing machine before I used to, before the row, I'd have a day of work, and then I was like, in my head, it would be my head letting me down. It'd be like, I could just go and sit and have a glass of wine and watch Netflix. And then this bit, the other bit of me is like, no, let's do it, because I really want to do that, but also let's just go and sit on a rowing machine for 45 minutes an hour and do that. And it's like finding ways of kind of pushing yourself into things that you really don't want to do, but they will get easier. And I think that's what I found with the, especially with the row, it's like there were times when I felt so utterly exhausted when I had like a shift come up. So obviously I was rowing, it depends, like 17 hours a day, but I'd split it out into like either 6 or 7 hours of rowing and then maybe like an hour or two break, 6 or 7 hours of rowing, etc. And it would kind of just change in the break. Obviously just the ability to go, I just want a little bit more sleep, or I just want to sit here for a little bit longer. And I think it's just that aspect of going, okay, if we do that, these are the consequences. So I would sit there and have a very pragmatic conversation with myself. I was like, well, if you take a longer nap, you're going to be out here longer. If you take a longer break, you're going to be out here longer. Just do the thing and then you will get there quicker. And I think that just that strength within me just grew and grew. And I think now on reflection, obviously kind of 6 months on from the row, I think I've realized that I probably didn't have the mental toughness before the row that I thought I did. I think I almost like fake it till you make it. I think it was just because in my head I was like, yeah, I can totally do this. I think I had to learn it on the row more than I really realized that I actually needed to.
So it's almost like the first step is the most important, and you have to do it to become it.
Yeah. And it is just kind of you just try the thing, do the thing, and then you might not feel like you're doing the best at it, or you're doing it in the way that you should be doing it.
Yeah.
But if you keep doing it, that will just increase that kind of your ability, and it's like your confidence and your self-belief, and then it will just become this kind of mental toughness that you really can just carry on, and you can really achieve anything that you really want to achieve. I think women as a group, we undermine ourselves and we downplay ourselves so much that we just have this thing that we're like, we're so self-critical. Mm-hmm. And I was the absolute epitome of this pre-row, because I was like, this isn't, you know, everything I'm doing isn't good enough. And for 75% of the row, that's how I felt, because I was like, I'm doing something wrong here. Something is going wrong. And I was getting so angry at myself, and it's, I just wasn't happy. I was like, this, what is it? And I think it took me all that time to realize, I was like, oh, why am I being so hard on myself?
Yeah,
I'm doing this thing. And so I think there is that kind of vulnerability aspect of kind of going, just realize, and like just to realize how incredible the thing that I've been trying to do is, and then also just the fact that you have managed to get to this to this space, and you're, you know, 250 miles outside of Antigua. So,
and that's, I think, something we're all privy to doing is not giving yourself enough credit, like, and looking at where you've come from, and then where you get to that, the finish point. And I think there'll be a lot of people that can relate to exactly what you said there, and something, listening to your story and knowing you, is something that I wouldn't have guessed. You know, the critical side, and that's really important, and that's like super amazing of you to share that, because I think the more we share about how we feel and what we go through, people go, oh, I didn't realise that they felt that too, but they still carried on, they still pushed through, will definitely help people out there. Like, you're such an inspiration to me with kind of everything that you do and your attitude and how you push forward and everything that you've been through. And I look forward to seeing what comes next, because I know it's not going to be small. anyone out there listening, go and check out Lara's socials, because there's going to be something, and it's going to be something massive. I think you're definitely on this route of showing people exactly what can be done, and doing it with an amazing attitude for life and appreciation. I feel kind of honoured to know you and to have been on this journey, you know, watching you do the row and coming out to film you and learning everything about you and your relationship with your dad. Thank you. I cannot express enough gratitude, and I think our listeners are going to absolutely love this episode. There would be one thing that I just kind of want to finish on, which I have kind of done with previous guests. Mm. And as a mom, mm. I think it's quite important. If you were now to be sat opposite, you can either close your eyes or just mm. do it like without. You're sat opposite, say, 12-year-old, 13-year-old Lara.
Mm.
Like, what do you want to say to her?
Two things. I think the first one is realise just what a good gig being at school is. Oh. Getting into adulthood is there's like taxes and everything. It's not okay. I don't think I appreciated that when I was 12. But also I think I massively tried to fit into a mould when I was a teenager specifically. I think I was like, I spent all this time when I was younger, when I was eight, like I said, when I was eight or nine, and I was just living what I was living and I was enjoying being that tomboy. I think 12 and 13 is such a hard age that I went, oh, I know you need to fit into this mold. I think if I hadn't done that more, I think if I just embraced who I really was, that would have been awesome.
Yeah.
And I think so do that, just be just you be. Because
yeah.
don't try and change.
Yeah. And you is enough. Like mm. you are enough. I think we don't say that enough.
Mm.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being a guest. You're absolutely awesome.
No, thank you. This has been amazing. I've got goosebumps. Is that normal? I don't know.
That's good.